Reported to be among three British women kidnapped and raped on an aid mission in Libya. Pro-government militia are said to have been behind the attack in the eastern city of Benghazi earlier this week. The Foreign Office says it's aware of an incident. Our political correspondent Sophie Ridge says the details are shocking.
Clearly a very sort of distressing incident here. And the Deputy Prime Minister of Libya has also actually been speaking to the women involved. They are in hospital. He says that they're in a very bad shape. And he's also spoken to their father as well, who was actually present and witnessed the attack.
The medical director of the NHS in England is defending his decision to suspend children's heart surgery at Leeds General Infirmary. Sir Bruce Keogh says mortality figures needed to be investigated. Campaigners have questioned the reliability of the stats. They're also concerned about the timing of the move, coming just a day after the High Court quashed plans to close the unit. But Sir Bruce says he had to act.
I was presented with some data which indicated that the death rates were higher than in other units. And given that set of events, I don't think that as National Medical Director, I could sit by and do nothing.
The worlds of stage and screen are paying tribute to Richard Griffiths, the award-winning performer, perhaps best known for his roles in the Harry Potter films, and With Nail and I, has died at the age of 65. A 41-year-old woman has been arrested on suspicion of child neglect after her daughter was found alone in a pram. The girl, who's 2.5, was discovered outside a house in Carlisle late last night. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
BCFM 93.2, the Bristol station you can count on. BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
It's Good Friday, 5 o'clock, BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is something a little bit different, someone a little bit different, Somerset-based member of the Communist Party, Ken Keeble. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the humiliation and chaos of Cyprus. But what would a major euro-dollar crash look like? Will there be cash in the tills and food in the supermarkets? Will savers lose everything? We take you through the two most likely doomsday scenarios and look at the events which might trigger it. Plus, a former Scotland Yard detective got a sinister and frosty response when he submitted his evidence to the Royal Commission on Banking. Who is he? Actually, sorry, the Parliamentary Commission on Banking. Who is he, and why didn't they want to hear the evidence? Plus, always on the hunt for a conspiracy that will stand up, we take a look at the cult US show that's compelling synthesis of ITV's Cook Report, which was taken off television in 2000 after 4 weeks of lies from Rupert Murdoch's News of the World, and the US programme The X-Files. Former US State Governor Jesse Ventura and his conspiracy theory show has been looking at how to assassinate people within the US and in the West and make it look like death by natural causes. Plus, we hear from Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's British wife, Asma, and Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Tonight, down to -5 and feeling even colder. Is it really Easter? Well, actually, the cold weather is slightly more understandable because Easter's so early this year, but this weekend, temperatures only up to a maximum of 5 or 6 degrees. Sunny tomorrow and sunny periods on Sunday. And don't forget, even though it's Easter, the clocks still go forward 1 hour on Saturday night, so don't forget. Staying cold next week, down to -4 overnight, and only rising to 7 or so during the daytime. Sunny generally, and no, some snow possibly even on Thursday next week. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of April, creeping up, temperatures creeping up to about 9 degrees Celsius, still sunny periods, a windy weekend, but it will feel very cold still. Week after next, the temperatures creeping up to 10 to 11 degrees Celsius, still down to freezing overnight though, and generally sunny the week after next. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. So helping us review this week's news is Somerset-based member of the Communist Party, Ken Keeble. Hi, Ken. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, the Communist Party, what is in its latest manifestations? There's all sorts of different Communist Parties, competing ones. Now, what's going on these days?
Well, yes, there are a number of organisations call themselves Communist Parties, and the different views. We're the largest of them in Britain, and we're campaigning for socialism, and we look to the labour movement. We orient ourselves very much towards the labour movement, the trade union movement, as we think that that's the body of people that's the biggest democratic organisation in Britain, over 6 million members, and that's the one that's got the potentially got the power to really change British society.
Okay, so what's your party's official title?
The Communist Party of Britain.
Okay. There are several questions always about communism that come up, sort of pop up. One is, does your party support the intervention back in the 1950s and the 60s, the Soviet intervention in Hungary? I mean, these are commonly known as tankies on the left, generally, people that supported the Soviet intervention in Hungary when the Hungarian people were uprising against the Soviet Union. What's your party's view on that?
On the Hungarian thing, well, I think that's actually a fascist attempt at counter-revolution, but of course it made use of quite genuine grievances which the people had at that time. There were genuine grievances. But
what about 1968 in Czechoslovakia?
Well, I don't think we have a particular view on that. That all happened before our particular party was founded, but I myself supported the intervention at that time, but of course since then we've seen that things were not as I saw them in the Soviet Union, so look at it a bit differently. But I think if Dubček had been allowed to go on, I think quite possibly it would have led to an earlier overthrow of socialism.
Because people will kind of look at it a bit like Tiananmen Square, when the tanks come in, the people are resisting in the streets, there's a kind of demonstration going on, in Parliament Square, it would be here in London maybe, or in Whitehall, and the government sends the tanks in. That's looked upon as a very authoritarian approach.
Yes, it is of course, but I think we have to view it in the light of the Cold War. That's the thing. That was what the basic world situation which dictated what people did and how people thought. It was the confrontation between the Warsaw Pact and NATO. We haven't got quite that situation now, but any country that tries to build a socialist society has this problem of the fact that the extremely rich and powerful Western powers do everything they possible internally and externally to overthrow it.
Okay, what about the fact that the Communist Party isn't the sort of thing that people would vote for? I mean, surely it's not really an electable party. A lot of people might be surprised that, we've got you on the radio today talking because, we don't have any communist councillors or MPs.
Well, we have had communist MPs in the past. There were two after the Second World War, of course. There was one earlier, a number earlier.
I know there was one nearly elected in the Rhondda Valley after World War Two.
Yes. And I say not electable. The thing is, people, there are still, the capitalist system is failing people, and so sooner or later people are going to look at it and say, well, we want something better, we want something different to that.
Now, you've
and
also...
We try to present a realistic way of achieving that. We know there are a lot of people who actually want capitalism, and they're welcome to it, but the way I look at it is this. After the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the capitalist system had a golden opportunity to show the world how good it is. What it did instead was to show the world how bad it is. And the same old things, the same old reasons for people turning against capitalism and wanting something better are all there. They're all there as they've always been. And we try to present a realistic way of actually achieving a socialist Britain and a socialist world.
Well, one of the things
that's a difficult task. And of course, the mistakes that have been made in the past, and in some cases the crimes committed, they're all a difficulty. But one can't overcome, one can't rewrite history and say it should be different. We do want to learn from the mistakes of the past. And we do want a democratic society in Britain, which is run in the interest not of the bankers as present, but in the interest of the great majority of the people.
And now you've got a communist newspaper. I think it was started in 1930. I was just looking it up last night, called The Daily Worker, which was renamed The Morning Star in 1966. And actually, you do see it around sometimes. Most news agents don't carry it, but it is possible, isn't it? How important is that to what you do?
Extremely important, extremely important. The Morning Star is the only socialist daily paper in Britain, and indeed in the English-speaking world. It's a very important thing. It's not owned by the Communist Party, but it's owned by a co-op. It's the only newspaper that is owned by a co-op, a readers' co-op. And there's been a big change in recent years, because a few years ago the rules were changed. The co-op that owns the Morning Star, the People's Press Printing Society, changed its rules so that any trade union which buys £20,000 worth of shares can get a seat on the management committee. And there are currently nine trade union representatives on the management committee of the People's Press Printing Society, which owns the Morning Star, and they represent in that sense more than half of Britain's trade union members. So we've got this very, very close relationship with the trade union movement, and that's very important to us.
Okay,
that's the most important thing.
One of the other criticisms of communism generally is that it's intolerant of faith. You know, people who have got a belief in religion, you know, go to church regularly. Is that the case with your party?
Not at all. My own view is I prefer not to discuss religion when I'm discussing politics. I prefer to keep it out of the subjects. We need to build the broadest possible movement against the bankers who are currently, the country is currently being run in the interest of a few tax-dodging multimillionaires whose wealth is measured not in millions of pounds, but in tens of millions, hundreds of millions, and in some cases thousands of millions of pounds. And we need the broadest possible movement of people against them. And that means we don't have to discuss religion.
But don't religious morals also impact on your values, on anyone's values?
The case for socialism is a moral case as well as an economic and political case. Certainly it is. But people can have socialist values with or without being religious. A religious label doesn't necessarily define somebody's morals. You can have a right-wing Christian and a left-wing Christian. You can have a socialist Christian. You can have a fascist Christian. Hitler was a Catholic, after all. You know, it doesn't define someone's morality.
Well, certainly the Vatican was used, wasn't it, at the end of the Second World War, as rat lines in the Vatican to smuggle Nazis out. But that's the religion being used.
I don't go in for religion bashing. You know, okay. There's no point. If people are willing to work with me in the peace movement, the trade union movement, and so on, whatever, I work with them, and I don't say which religion are you.
One of the things I rather liked about, I mean, this is the last time I met you a few months ago, is you gave me this leaflet about the People's Charter. Tell us about that. Because this is one thing I think in the modern political world is we don't have a lot of sort of positive vision. Back in the 1800s we had the Chartists, and I like to think that, you know, political parties now along can come along with a vision like they did.
Well, the name People's Charter for Change is in fact harking back to that tradition of the Charter, which called for basically, it was Britain's civil rights movement, calling for democracy.
I know it's quite long. Can you just sum it up?
I'll sum it up, yes. Well, there's 6 points. A fairer economy for a fairer Britain, more and better jobs, decent homes for all, protect and improve our public services, no cuts, fairness and justice, and building a secure and sustainable future for all, which is the green agenda and the peace agenda. And basically it's the reverse of what the government is trying to do. You're right, a lot of people say no cuts, no this, no that, and we think that people have got to have something positive to say, and this is the People's Charter has been adopted by the Trade Union Congress as official policy, and it's supported by 17 trade unions nationally, so it's got that really solid basis of support. It needs to be translated into action. It needs to be we need to get more people who've signed up to it to actually come out and talk about it, and the TUC officials don't do enough of that. But it's the reverse of the government's austerity programme.
Well, I mean, what's happened in the past with People's Charter back all those years ago with the Chartists, and also of course with the Levellers in the Civil War, is these things tend to have a momentum of their own, and sometimes their time comes, even if they're bubbling away in the background and people don't know they're there, suddenly yes. People realise, well, now is the time.
I think that the People's Charter has the potential to win the support of millions of people. That's what I believe. What the government is trying to do with its austerity programme is to roll back all the social gains made by the British people since 1945, and it's trying to rob the poor and the majority of the people to transfer the wealth to the super rich. And the super rich are actually richer now than they were in 2008 or 2007 before the credit crunch. They're doing very, very well out of it. Very well indeed. We would like to see taxation on the super rich. We could have a 2% wealth tax, for example, on the top richest 10% of the people. That would bring in £90 billion, which is twice what the government is cutting in public services just this year. We want to see more a higher level of taxation, income tax on the super rich. We want to see a wealth tax. We want to see a higher corporation tax, and we want to see a windfall tax on the the banks, on the big oil companies, energy companies, the electricity and so on, and the pharmaceuticals. They've done very, very well, and we would like to see a tax on those, and that would provide all the money and more, plenty of money that's needed to restore the public
services.
It's
funny that you
to stop cutting benefits but actually increase benefits, because what's needed in the economy is more demand. The reason we've got so many shops closed in the city and all the towns and cities is because of lack of demand. It's not because of red tape or the high cost of employing people. It's lack of demand in the economy, and that's what we need, to more demand. And we do that by giving money to the poor, not to the rich.
Okay, Ken, it's funny that you mentioned banking, the energy industry and the pharmaceutical industry, because I've just done a little bit of work for last week's show, which we can talk about a bit today as well, which is looking at criminality in the banking sector, in the energy sector, for example, LIBOR style fixing of crude oil prices, LIBOR style price fixing in the gas market, and also bribery by the pharmaceutical companies. So it seems that the companies or the industries that you're interested in doing windfall taxes on are actually riddled with criminality. Anyway, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, first of all, is this something I thought I hadn't managed to miss Ed Balls speaking at the budget speech last week, but he didn't say anything. It was Ed Miliband giving the speech. Why do you think Ed Balls has been sidelined? Surely he's the guy, as a shadow chancellor, who should be up there batting with George Osborne.
Well, my answer to that is I don't know. Ed Miliband picked up the ball and ran with it. I think they've been caught because they've basically, both Balls, Ball certainly was involved in financial policy when he was working for Gordon Brown, and basically they let the City of London get away with murder during that period, and then of course were completely disarmed when the whole thing goes belly up, because they were responsible for the light touch regulation which allowed this crisis to come on us. So that has actually hamstrung the Labour movement.
Isn't it time to shift that? Ed Balls aside, and if so, do you think who should take over? Maybe our local MP Kerry McCarthy.
Well, the way I think about this is it's a matter of incremental changes. If we have a major row between the left and the right in the Labour Party, we could potentially lose the next election. So we're not going to do that. But gradually, because the nature of the crisis is such that radical measures will become inevitable. And I'd just like to reiterate what Ken has been saying about demand in the economy. This is absolutely the way to go. Even the capitalists are beginning to realise that if you keep cutting like this, you're just going to crash everything. And that's, we saw this in Cyprus the other week. This is going to force the pace of economic change in terms of what's possible and what's discussable. And of course, it's very good that the People's Charter exists, and we've got to put more meat on those bones. Ultimately, we are going to have a socialist society. I believe that. I'm still in the Labour Party, though.
I was looking at the website of the magazine Money Week a couple of days ago, and they do a very graphic graph there showing you just how much the national debt is still climbing at an incredible rate. I mean, talking about the deficit is almost irrelevant if the national debt is still climbing at an even faster and faster rate. We're now looking at having double debt, that is in about around about £1.4 trillion of national debt. That's double what it was in the 2010 election. I mean, surely they can't get out of it by these current policies.
No, they can't, because of course GDP is actually small smaller than it was when the coalition came to power. So the debt to GDP ratio continuously gets worse as the economy flatlines and potentially goes backwards.
Quite a rate.
And this is the reason why the capitalist ratings agencies are circling around like vultures. I mean, when Nick Clegg came to Bristol after he'd just been elected, I said, the problem with the policy you're going to pursue, Nick, is that you're doing it to protect the country's credit rating, but you're going to lose the country's credit rating. Let's imagine if Labour had won the election and they'd carried on spending. It's not clear that they would have done, but let's say they did, then you might have lost your credit rating, but you would have also had 5% higher level of GDP, so you'd have had more money to pay for all of the money you were borrowing. And the basically what happens in a crisis like this is debts and deficits go up, and the coalition government are like King Canute saying, we're going to stop this going up. No, it's a capitalist crisis. It's going to go up because capitalism is bust.
Okay, a couple of other things this week. Just hang on a second, Ken. This week is the anniversary, the 27th of March 1963, 50 years ago this week, of the publishing of a report called The Reshaping of British Railways, better known as the Beeching Report. Martin, this had a big effect on our railway network. Something like half the railway lines were closed down. With hindsight, what are your thoughts about 50 years on?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the subsidy from the taxpayer to the privatised railway is 300% higher than the subsidy when it was a nationalised industry. And, of course, nobody else...
And that was only in the early 90s.
Yes, and nobody else in the world tries to run mass transit at a profit. We pretend that we run it at a profit, but what that means is that private companies are skimming off they're skimming off the revenue stream. It's completely stupid, and Labour had 13 years in power to reverse it, and they didn't do anything about it.
And I know Richard Cotterill, the former MEP for the South West, Conservative MEP, is just publishing a book at the moment about this, where he fingers Beeching as a former chairman of ICI, not only with doing a lot to destroy ICI as a business, which was Imperial Chemical Industries, which had played a major part in doing building explosives and things like that in the Second World War. Not only did he destroy ICI, he was also on the project team of the British atom bomb.
Well, yes, I mean, there's a revolving door with these kind of people, isn't there? I mean, look at David Miliband disappearing to go and head up the International Rescue Committee in New York, which is actually basically funded by the US government. People get looked after, don't they?
Finally, Boris Berezovsky, he was found dead last weekend. Now, who is Boris Berezovsky? I know you think he's quite a key figure in East-West relations, was.
Well, I used to work in the former Soviet Union in the 1990s, and he was a fairly powerful character.
I mean, what are the oligarchs?
The oligarchs are the... There are nine oligarchs, as I remember, in the former USSR. They basically got hold of the whole of Soviet industry, and they became the multimillionaires who were running it, but of course they didn't build those industries up. They
just snaffled
them.
Well, is that sort of privatisation sort of thing?
Right, privatisation.
So from a socialist, essentially communist economy, these individuals actually managed to turn large parts of that into their own private fiefdoms.
Indeed they did. And of course the Communist Party of Russia was going to win the election in September 1999, Zyuganov was set to become president, and then suddenly all these bombs went off in Moscow and Ryazan, killing hundreds of working class people in their housing estates, and it was blamed on the Chechens, and they invaded Chechnya. But that was all orchestrated by Berezovsky, who at that stage was working with Putin to keep the communists out.
Now, many people say that Berezovsky helped get Putin into power.
But then Putin double-crossed him. But of course what's happened, Putin is a nationalist, he's not a communist. The Russian Communist Party is still quite strong in Russia.
It is indeed.
They are the main opposition.
Yes.
The West keeps talking about the sort of liberal elite as the main opposition to Putin. The main opposition to Putin still comes from the Communist Party. And the Communist Party has changed, although Zyuganov is still the leader. They haven't changed the leader. His thing in 1999, he says, I wasn't responsible for the main mess, I was just an ordinary guy running a very low-level town. I'm just basically an ordinary Communist Party member. And he's carried on being the leader. He must be getting on now. But, of course, all of that was in order to prevent the communists from coming to power. So the bombs were not carried out by the Chechens. They were carried out probably by the FSB. That's what was in Litvinenko's book, Blowing Up Russia.
And this, of course, is the Russian Secret Service.
Putin and Berezovsky. And Berezovsky was like the Rupert Murdoch of Russian politics. So that's
he had newspapers, and he also had the franchise for...
Berlusconi thing.
And he had the franchise for Mercedes cars as well.
And basically Putin was brought in by the oligarchs on the back of the false flag bombings in order to keep the communists out.
Now, how does this relate to this Litvinenko inquest? Because that Boris Berezovsky was going to be one of the major witnesses at that inquest, which is coming up next month.
The British don't really want to talk about this, because if they start talking about the false flag attacks by the FSB to keep the Communist Party out of power in 1999 in Russia, Putin's going to turn around and say, yes, and what about 9/11? Who did that? Because, of course, the Russians know very well General Ivashov, who was commander of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, 2001, quite clear, everybody can see it was on the internet. As far as we're concerned, the Americans did that to themselves. But of course, the Russians should know, because they did that to them. The oligarchs did that to the Russian people in 1999. It's a very dangerous situation. These kind of people are very ruthless gangsters, whether they're Russian or United States gangsters. They're all pretty much of a muchness.
So what's your rain check on Berezovsky? Do you think he killed himself? I know his family said they didn't believe he would do.
Well, it's possible. It's possible also that people killed him. Litvinenko, I mean, what Putin said about Litvinenko was that why would we kill him with polonium, which you can track polonium. It's radioactive. It leaves a trace. Why use something like that when somebody may have broken into Berezovsky's flat and just strangled him with a scarf, which is, a lot easier than using polonium radioactive material.
Ken, I wonder if you'd like to come in and say anything about the Berezovsky and, his political background and what you think about, him being found dead last weekend.
Not really, no. I'd like rather discuss the problems that face us in the British economy, in the British political situation, which we have some control over. This is all something we've got no control over. I don't really want to discuss it.
Okay.
Talk about the People's Assembly Against Austerity. That's what
you can do.
Like
yes, you
to.
Can talk about.
It's
that.
Very important development, I think. You see an organisation called the Coalition of Resistance, headed by Tony Benn, has called for a meeting at the Central Hall, Westminster, on the 22nd of June in London, the People's Assembly Against Austerity. I'd like to read out, if I may, the call for this.
So long as it's not too long, Ken, yeah, go for it.
Well, this is a call to all those millions of people in Britain who face an impoverished and uncertain year as their wages, jobs and conditions and welfare provision come under renewed attack by the government. I'll cut some of it out. But he says, the Assembly will provide a national forum for building confidence of those promoting anti-austerity views, which, whilst increasingly popular, are barely represented in Parliament. A People's Assembly can play a key role in ensuring that this uncaring government faces a movement of opposition broad enough and powerful enough to generate the conditions where successful coordinated action called by the unions, including strike action, is impossible. And it's a very important thing, and the call is signed by seven trade union leaders, general secretaries, four MPs, including three Labour MPs and Caroline Lucas of the Green Party, a number of authors, Tariq Ali, John Pilger, Ken Loach, Owen Jones, James Bedway, is supported by Imran Khan, Lindsay German of the Stop the War Coalition, Kate Hudson, General Secretary of the CND, Bruce Kent, peace campaigner, and so on. A number of prominent public figures, actor Roger Lloyd Pack, Josie Long, Ian Banks, Arthur Smith, the comedian, and so on, Roy Bailey. So people are calling for this, and it's intended to be very broad. I'm pretty sure it's going to be discussing the People's Charter, of course, as part of that. I hope it'll have a really big effect on building up confidence and building a sense that, yes, there is a genuine opposition here. It's not in Parliament, but a genuine opposition that wants something really different.
Well, I hate to contradict you, but here's a little bit of opposition we're going to hear from now, which is in Parliament. And this was about 10 o'clock at night on Monday this week, because the budget debate goes on for several days. And what it effectively means is that, yes, all the MPs can contribute, but when they do, the chamber will be virtually empty, as it was when Michael Meacher, the Labour MP, gave his take on this. And of course, maybe Martin, you can let us know a bit about his background. I know he was one of the longest serving, if not the longest serving present members of Labour cabinets. I mean, he's a senior guy in the party, but we hardly ever hear from him. So who is Michael Meacher?
Well, he's part of the campaign group, and he's part of the left bloc, if you like, inside the Labour Party.
Okay, well, let's hear from him now, his budget speech.
Meacher.
Here, here.
In a budget with populist gimmicks, whilst at the same time wholly ignoring the economic fundamentals that are remorselessly driving this country into a semi-permanent stagnation, is, in my view, to degrade the high office of Chancellor. The home loan scheme has more than a whiff of subprime about it, luring people without the means to buy houses they cannot afford and thereby fueling a housing bubble. The childcare voucher is limited to where both parents are working, and it is offering five times more to the richest fifth compared to the poorest fifth. And as for the penny off a pint of beer, it doesn't do much to compensate for the 9% cut in real wages, which the OBR is now expecting by 2015 compared to 2009. But all of this populist flannel, I don't think it's the real point. The real point is the total abandonment of any serious attempt whatsoever in this budget to tackle the fundamental problems of a desperately ailing economy. The tragedy for the people of this country is that in this depression, what we have is Herbert Hoover at the controls, when what the whole country is crying out for is a Franklin Roosevelt. The harshly unrelenting facts of Britain's inexorable decline, I think, speak for themselves. The OBR has been forced to halve the growth prediction for this year, which it made only 3 months ago, from 1.2 to 0.6%. The deficit reduction, the ostensible aim of the whole brutal austerity machine, is now actually going into reverse. The deficit now expected in 2014 is £120 billion, twice what it was expected to be just 3 years ago. And by the time of the election in 2015, the government will have been forced to borrow an extra £250 billion, that's nearly a quarter of £1 trillion, more than was forecast in 2010. And I simply say, any hope of the Chancellor on these plans achieving a firm and sustainable recovery is simply delusional. Now, the heart of any budget is its macroeconomic strategy. What was unique in this budget is there was no credible strategy. In this budget, the Chancellor's policy is still so destructive and the failure so massive that it's very difficult to avoid the conclusion that the real objective isn't deficit reduction at all, but to dismantle the public sector and shrink the state. And one simply has to ask, why is the Chancellor so willfully blind to an alternative? Now, an alternative must start from recognising that when the household and private sectors are deleveraging, there cannot be a recovery if the public sector does the same. It also starts from recognising that monetary policy alone, that is throwing $375 billion of quantitative easing at the banks, dropping interest rates to the floor and letting the exchange rate fall by 25%, cannot by themselves alone produce growth, or as Mark Carney would put it, not much escape velocity there. And third, it also starts from accepting that until the collapse in aggregate demand is tackled, there will be no recovery. Now, how can that be engineered and paid for? It has to be initially a public sector driven investment program in house building, in infrastructure, in energy, in transport, in low carbon technology, until such time as the private sector can take over. It can be paid for by borrowing £30 billion at the dirt cheap 0.5% interest rate, £150 million a year, which would very rapidly pay for itself in short time by taking back into employment 1 million workers who are currently costing the country £10 billion to keep them on the dole. But it doesn't have to involve any public borrowing at all. The nationalised banks, RBS and Lloyds, could be instructed to prioritise to lend to key infrastructure manufacturing projects, or the ultra-rich, the 14,000 millionaires who are about to get a £2,000 a week tax giveaway, could be capital gains taxed on the £155 billion gains they've made over the last 3 years, according to the Sunday Times, or instead of hosing down the banks with another huge tranche of quantitative easing, that money could be diverted to direct investment in industry.
Well, I kind of agree with all of that, and I suspect that Ken does as well.
Well, I do, and I think that a very important point that he made, I mean, he was largely making the case for the People's Charter there, he was outlining it really, but the very important point that he made, that the deficit reduction is not the true aim of this government's policy, so it's not failing in terms of what they really want to do, it's succeeding. They're transferring wealth from the poor to the rich, and they're dismantling the welfare state.
Well, they, I mean, what he's saying there is actually dismantling the entire state, including things like armed forces.
No, not the entire state. The capitalist class, the tax-dodging multi-millionaires in whose interests this country is run, they need the state. They need the state. They need a British state which provides a legal basis for their existence. They need a state which is on the UN Security Council, which is in NATO, which is in the EU, which provides a legal home for them to pursue their worldwide activities. Now, they certainly need the state, but there's parts of the state, what we call the state, that they don't need. They don't need free public services and so on. They don't want that. They want everything to be marketized and a source of profit.
Martin, he made a reference there to Roosevelt and Hoover. What was that about?
Well, I mean, he's using the US example because, of course, you know... After the 1929 crash, the mainstream economic philosophy was a laissez-faire free market philosophy, Thatcherism, if you like, before Thatcher came along. And basically, Roosevelt came to power in 1933 in the US, and he basically had a crash program of public investment paid for by borrowing and also by raising taxes on the wealthy. You can't just do it through borrowing. We've got to actually raise taxes as well. And of course, that actually started to get the economy moving while Britain was still floundering around and many other countries were floundering around. Of course, what really got the economy moving was the war. And of course, that's what we've got in the US. We've got a state which actually spends more on warfare than welfare. And of course, to some extent, that works. But eventually, of course, everything has to be paid for.
Now, there was another rather fiery event in the political world. Well, this time not in the House of Commons. This was on the Andrew Marr show. And as Andrew Marr's ill, it was Eddie Mayer who interviewed Boris Johnson, the London Mayor, Conservative and Bullingdon Club member, along with George Osborne and David Cameron.
The Times let you go after you made up a quote. Why did you make up a quote?
Well, this again, you know, these are big terms for what happened. Well, I can tell you the whole thing. I mean, are you sure our viewers wouldn't want to hear more about
how it was a long and
lamentable story.
Okay, but you made it
which
up.
Well, what happened was that I ascribed events that were supposed to have taken place before the death of Piers Gaveston to events that actually took place after the death
of Piers
Gaveston.
Let me ask you about another little line.
I mean, I mildly sandpapered something somebody said.
Let me ask you about a barefaced lie.
It's very embarrassing. I'm very sorry about it.
Let me ask you about a barefaced lie. When you were in Michael Howard's team, you denied to him you were having an affair. It turned out you were. And he sacked you for that. Why did you lie to your party?
Well, I mean, again, I mean, with great respect. On that, I never had any conversation with Michael Howard about that matter. And, you know, I didn't...
You did lie to him.
Well, you know, I don't propose to go into all that again.
I don't blame you.
No, well, why should I? I mean, I've been through, that question a lot with the watch the documentary.
Okay.
Why are we talking about something else?
The programme also includes, well, this is about your integrity.
Okay.
The programme includes your reaction as you listen to a phone call in which your friend, Darius Guppy, asks you to supply the address of a journalist so that he can have him physically assaulted. The words beaten up and broken ribs are said to
him.
And you, having heard that, you tell your friend, Darius Guppy, you will supply the address. What does that say about you, Boris Johnson?
Right.
Aren't you, in fact, making up quotes, lying to your party leader, wanting to be part of someone being physically assaulted? You're a nasty piece of work, aren't you?
Well, I think all three things I would dispute.
Well, you don't factually dispute them.
Well, I do, and I could, you know, if we had a long time, which we don't, I could explain that I think all three interpretations you're putting on those things aren't wholly fair. And certainly the final thing which you raise, which is the case of my old friend Darius. Yes, it was certainly true that he was in a bit of a state, and I did humour him in a long phone conversation from which absolutely nothing eventuated, and you know, there you go. But I think if any of us had our phone conversations bugged, they might, you know, people say all sorts of fantastical things whilst they're talking to their friends.
That was the London Mayor, Boris Johnson, Conservative London Mayor, talking to Eddie Mayer on the Andrew Marr Show. Now, Ken Keeble from the Communist Party, what did you think of that exchange?
I watched that programme, just amazing, utterly disgusting. It shows what a thoroughly dangerous man Boris Johnson is, because he's a cheat and a liar, and he admits to all these terrible things he's done, and he's all a joke, and he gets away with it because he's got a nice, affable personality and a way of shrugging off almost anything.
But, Ken, nobody's perfect, are they?
Well, no, but he's the Mayor of London, and he's a very great friend and protector of the city, which is one of the most awful institutions in British society that we've got to bring under democratic control, and he doesn't want to do that. He's a great friend of the city, which is a centre of money laundering and tax dodging.
But, I mean, it's also the centre of wealth, and, I mean, whilst we're going through some difficult times at the moment, the city is actually the generator of the wealth of the nation.
It's not the generator of wealth. It uses wealth that other people have created to exploit people to create more wealth, and it's something we need to bring under democratic control. We need, as it says in the People's Charter, we need to bring the whole financial sector into public ownership, make it work for the people. We can't run an economy on the basis of the financial sector, which is what we're trying to do, which is something like what Standard Wage Cyprus is trying to do. We can't do that. This is ludicrous. It's the thing hardly anybody talks about, the City of London. There's a very good book published about it a little while ago. I'm sorry, I know, I forgot.
Well, while you're trying to remember, but, Martin, I'll let me ask you about Boris Johnson was saying there. Treasure Island, okay.
Yes.
What Boris was saying there about, I mean, for example, he's saying, you know, if anyone was to have their phone tapped, he does make quite a good point there. You know, that if these confidential phone conversation is then relayed and then gets on the national newspapers, nobody's perfect, are they?
No, but I mean, a lot of the people at the top in our society are in fact criminal, like his friend Darius, who he's referring to, was sent to prison for attempted fraud.
Darius, in fact, he calls him, yes.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of the people at the top are in fact criminals in lots of different ways. And we've got, as you know, Tony, information about South Africa's missing nuclear weapons, which were bought by a private consortium around Astra Holdings, and lots of Tory MPs were involved in that, and they made personal profits from it, as we've been hearing. Basically, there is the ruling class are in fact criminal. Now, if you read Marx, and he's talking about in Das Kapital, he tries to give the capitalist class the best arguments that they can possibly come up with. So he says, let's presume that the capitalists are at least honest. And even if they're honest, they're still stealing, because he shows how they're still stealing. But the fact is, they're not even honest. And what has now happened is that the main commanding heights of the economy are run by organised crime. And many of the people who went to Eton College are implicated in this.
Okay, on to another story. And Ken Clark has misled Parliament over the secret courts bill. Campaigners claiming that the Minister Without Portfolio gave the Commons wrong information about whether the ancient writ of habeas corpus will be undermined by the Justice and Security Bill. Habeas corpus, first used in Britain in 1305, is invoked to demand that a prisoner be released from unlawful detention and is regarded as one of the fundamental safeguards of liberty. Were secret court sessions, known as closed material procedures, to be allowed in such cases, campaigners fear that those challenging their imprisonment could lose their case without knowing why, because evidence used against them but deemed to be sensitive in terms of security would be kept secret. This weakness went through the House of Lords. Finally, it's passed. Ken, this is called the Secret Courts Bill, and in fact it's not actually called that, but Amnesty International have warned of a terrible day for British justice after the Lib Dem peers obeyed a three-line government whip to reject amendments to strengthen the role of judges in these new secret courts.
Well, I agree with Amnesty International there. I think it's disgraceful. It's a great step back for British justice. The secret courts, we just don't need secret courts. We mustn't have secret courts. That's what it brings in, where even the accused, as lawyers, can't see the evidence that's been presented against them and what the case is to answer. It's something which is awful.
It seems, Martin, I don't know what you think about this, that since he became Minister Without Portfolio, this has been one of the major roles behind the scenes of Kenneth Clark, is to make sure that this bill goes through.
And he's one of those that we're being told profited from the sale of South Africa's nuclear weapons. And, of course, the problem is not just that miscarriages of justice may take place. Criminality can be covered up if there are secret courts. Yes. So in other words, we're not just talking about that's innocent right. people being caught, we're talking about the guilty getting away with it, because this is the whole point of having secret courts, is that you can then, intelligence services and so on can manipulate outcomes so that criminality can be protected. That's the problem.
Yeah, especially if the guilty party is in fact the government or a minister.
Indeed.
That's the point.
Claire Olgar, who's the executive director of the human rights charity Reprieve, said this is a disastrous result for British justice. Not only are we now facing a wave of secret courts at odds with our centuries-old legal freedoms, but we have not even seen the minor safeguards upheld which would have made them less dangerous. It's deeply shameful the government has been allowed to push these plans through Parliament despite the total lack of evidence that they are needed. Secret courts will not make us any safer. They will, however, do irreparable damage to our reputation as a country which respects fair play and the rule of law, Martin.
Well, we like to think we respect fair play and the rule of law, but you could ask the people in Kenya about that, with hundreds of thousands of them who died under torture when Britain was running the place in the 1950s. I mean, and they're suing the British government at the moment for castration, electrocution and murder.
It does seem that terrorism, even though we get a lot of the talk about the terrorism threat, actually one of the biggest threats to justice, Ken, is Ken Clark, not the terrorists.
Well, I agree with that. Yes, indeed. And this whole war on terror that we got, where we're sort of permanently at war with some vague Muslim, you know, international threat and so on, it's very convenient for those who want to restrict our liberties here in Britain. Very convenient, and that's what they're doing.
Okay, another story, Martin. Welfare cuts. This is the Post, the Bristol Post. I like to call it the Evening Post, but it isn't apparently. Welfare cuts are costing Bristol £100 million a year. This is on Tuesday by Ian Onions, political editor. Government cuts in welfare benefits are costing the Bristol economy an estimated £100 million a year, according to the council. For every pound we receive in our pockets, the value to the local economy is up to 2.5 times as great. This is an accepted economic fact known as the multiplier effect. Council officers have now worked out that during the three-year period up to 2014-15, the total loss to benefit claimants in Bristol will be around £125 million. When you apply this multiplier effect, the cost to the local economy over 3 years is about £312 million.
Yes, I mean, as I've stressed week after week on this show, it's not just that these policies are unfair and punitive and basically lining the pockets of the rich at the expense of the poor. They are also stupid, because what you are doing ultimately is pushing us towards a further crash. I'm afraid that what may happen long before we bring in the People's Charter is that the capitalist banking system will simply crash and fail. Catastrophically.
Well, we will actually be talking about that in part two.
Then, of course, we're not in a situation, we're not in Kansas anymore when we get to that point, are we?
Ken, the facts speak for themselves, we're told. Only 3% of benefits actually goes to the people who are unemployed, because, of course, there are various amounts that just go immediately on bills and various other overheads and outgoings. Council officers are now bracing themselves for a range of benefit cuts, which are starting to kick in and affect the amount of money that families, couples and single people have each week to live on. Many pensioners are worried about how much money they'll receive, but they're not affected by these cutbacks. The cuts began 2 years ago with child benefit, which affects 50,000 people in Bristol. For many parents, this cut was not such a bitter pill to swallow if they were both working. But, for example, with a single mum with a part-time job, the cut makes a big difference to the family's quality of life.
Yes, indeed. And the cover for all this, of course, is the campaign that's going on from the capitalist media and various politicians, is the demonisation of the working class and demonisation of people who live on benefits, or people who are living on not on benefits, but on that have got their wages are so low that they have to top them up with benefits. They're all being demonised as scroungers and so on, when in fact it's that's not the case. And it's all a cover for, in fact, transferring wealth from the poor to the rich and closing down our public services. It is a disaster in economic terms, but it's a disaster for the people. I see that Bristol now has 7 food banks, and 1,000 people a week are visiting them. And these people are now beginning to come from the more prosperous areas, not just the poorest areas of the city. Well, people are in work even are going to food banks because their wages are so low they just can't live on them.
So you were saying that there was actually a large number of applications for a particular job application this week.
Yes,
if you can lay your hands on that information.
DFS opening up a new furniture store in Longwell Green.
But there's not a lot of point in applying anymore.
Nine jobs they advertised, and they've got 1,200 applicants, so I'm told. So that's the kind of thing that's going on.
Martin, there aren't enough jobs to go around. Is there any way that we can get out of this bind? Because it does seem that this is a kind of a fixed situation, and that the debt, national debt, is going up and up and up, and there's no way out of it. We almost seem to be staring down the barrel of a gun.
Yeah, well, ultimately, we've got to have resistance by the working class and a change of policy, both in Britain and across Europe and elsewhere in the world, in the United States as well. I mean, ultimately, there is the game that is being played is coming to an end, because austerity doesn't work. So the coalition here, the Troika in the EU, the Republicans in the US are pushing for more austerity. In other words, make the poor pay. But the poor can't pay. The poor haven't got any money. The only people who can pay are the wealthy. Now, ultimately, that is just a fact that will have to be confronted. And what may well happen, I'm sorry to say, is that we've wasted 4 years of fiddling around, and that was the time when we should have been implementing the People's Charter, but the political will wasn't there. I'm afraid what is likely to happen now is a disorderly capitalist collapse, followed by a world war, followed possibly by a socialist revolution, possibly by chaos.
We'll be looking at a couple of scenarios for that in part two. But we don't need to look too far. All we need to do is have a little look at Cyprus. And Faisal Islam on Channel 4 News was there yesterday when this jet arrived from Frankfurt with 10 billion euros in it. And G4S were busy distributing it all over the country on Wednesday in time for the banks to open yesterday. So let's have a listen to that report.
Here today, two remarkable developments. Those draconian capital controls that were only finalised at midnight, limiting euro withdrawals, but also an incredible logistical operation to get banknotes to every corner of this island. And I saw it all in 24 balmy hours in the coastal town of Larnaca, which also hosts the airport. It's not quite helicopter money, but these were the choppers accompanying a remarkable Operation Euro to replenish Cyprus with banknotes that it could not print itself. A cargo plane full of euros landed yesterday, courtesy of this island's central bank, based in Frankfurt, 1,600 miles away, the European Central Bank. This is what you have to do as a small country in a single currency. Wait for Mario Draghi, ECB president, to air freight the billions to you just hours before your banks are due to open to a bewildered public. And then for armed guards and those choppers to accompany it to the local central bank in four green trucks, ready for the replenishment of a nation's cash stock. The police escort extended to G4S fans, passing each other on Nicosia's roads, delivering the cash across the country. By mid-morning, across Cyprus, hundreds of bank branches had long queues.
That was Faisal Islam on Channel 4 News. Ken, I mean, this is a bizarre situation. You've got a plane load of cash arriving and to be distributed around the country. And one wonders, you know, what would have happened if they hadn't managed to cut that deal?
Well, I think the Cyprus situation illustrates very well what we communists have always said about the European Union. It's an instrument of the bankers against the people. That's what it's for. It's a way of running Europe for the benefit of the bankers. And their contempt for the people is shown by the way they treated the people of Cyprus.
Okay.
Trying to get the people to solve the problems of the super rich again.
Okay.
And it's wrong.
Before we hear from Martin on this, let's hear from Marina Morris, who's been out to talk to you, to ask you what you think about the Cyprus banking collapse and whether you're concerned that it may happen here.
How concerned are you about a possible banking collapse, and what would you do if the banks were closed?
Well, in this country, you would hope it's hypothetical, but leading from what has happened in other countries, you are starting to wonder now whether it could happen here as well. For all intents and purposes, yes, I would be worried. Apart from withdrawing all your money from the bank immediately, there's not a great deal else you can do. You just rely on the systems and you rely on the government that will protect you in those circumstances. I'm hoping that unless the country goes through the hoop, that the banks will remain fluent and will have the money in their coffers to be able to pay me back if I ask them for it.
In the UK? Yeah, it won't happen in the UK. Because all of the UK banks are really well capitalised now, I don't think it's possible in the UK. I think other banks in the Eurozone will, quite clearly as happened this week in Cyprus. Well, in the UK, under the financial compensation scheme, up to £100,000 of money is protected, so I don't have more than £100,000 with any one UK bank. Again, I would be relatively well insulated from that, so not too many concerns, really.
I'm not that concerned simply because, at the moment, I have nothing but debts. Oh, my God. God, nothing but debts. If the entire thing fell in on itself, then I wouldn't be that much worse off. As a serious answer, that is a terrifying question. If the banks close, then businesses are going to start going under en masse at a rate we've not seen since the Great Depression. I can't say that I have a plan for it because it would be such an apocalyptic event on our society. At the level of individual people? Honestly, I don't think we can. I think that if this comes, it's going to be a tidal wave that will swallow the average person whole, and only serious governments and businesses have any kind of influence over our outcome of this.
I'm just watching the television and I'm hearing the radio sometimes, that's it. I don't have a big idea about what's going on there. No, I think what's happened in Cyprus is the same like what's happened in Greece. They're going to have the same problem. I think it's an economic problem, it's the same. After that, maybe it's going to be in Portugal, it's the same. I have to keep my money with me, that's it.
Quite concerned, I suppose. I don't tend to follow politics much anymore, but obviously it has big implications. No, it's a real danger. If you can't access my money, I'd be pretty angry about it, for obvious reasons. Depends how much notice I have, I suppose, how sudden it is, and how much warning you have to sort something out. Withdraw your money and hide it under a bed. Take your money out and have it in lots of different accounts. It's very difficult in the modern world to do much beyond that, really, because obviously there are lots of financial mechanisms where you have to save it in a bank and you have little other choice.
Yes, little other choice is the way that finished, Martin.
That's right, and I think that also the chap saying that there's no real danger to British banks, they don't seem to understand that the derivatives market, the shadow banking system, is far bigger than the official banking sector. And if a country leaves the euro, for example Cyprus or Greece, then all these credit default swaps will come due for people who bet against that outcome. But of course what then happens is everybody starts ransacking the banks for their counterparties who are going to fulfill the bets that they've taken.
I mean,
and they won't be found, and at that point you get a catastrophic collapse.
Why is it that the banks are allowed to lend out and give out far more money than they actually got in deposits? Surely that's a sensible thing to do, is to only allow a bank to lend out money when they've actually got it, because it seems that if everybody wants to get their money at the same time, that's kind of what's fueling this problem in the first place, that there isn't enough money to go around. I mean, surely if you've got a system where there is enough money to go around, this could never happen.
Well, you could have a publicly run system where the money supply is provided by the public banks controlled by the government, and in fact that's probably where we're going to end up. But the problem is that the deregulation of the financial markets in the 1980s by the right wing, and in the 1990s by the so-called left wing, when they got rid of the separation between investment banks and retail banks, allowed this situation to develop where this is basically a system which is set up to fail. And frankly, most of the mainstream haven't grasped this, that the real danger of a country leaving the euro, or a country like, I don't know, Argentina finding itself unable to pay, means that the whole banking system, and Britain of course is at the centre of the world banking system, so if that chap thinks that he's not going to be affected by banking collapse, Britain is probably going to be at ground zero for that sort of catastrophe.
Okay, we'll be continuing this discussion in part two, but another story: MI5 chief Sir Jonathan Evans is to step down next month. Head of MI5 to step down from his post, Theresa May has said. She paid tribute to his 33 years with the security service, and he's going to be replaced by someone called Andrew Parker, who was very apparently partly managed the MI5's internal security services response to 7/7 and also the liquid bomb plot, Martin.
Yeah, well, there's not a lot of time, so I'd rather comment about Evans. Evans was the chap who said in the run-up to the Olympic Games, A, that G4S were perfectly adequate to manage the security, which this show exposed as rubbish and led to the G4S being forced off the contract. And secondly, said the main threat to the Olympic Games came from Iran. I don't believe that for a minute. That's Israeli propaganda. So the guy basically is in the pocket of the Israelis and the Americans. Good riddance to bad rubbish. The new fella, well, it's MI5.
And it was also worth pointing out that Lieutenant Colonel Nigel Wilde, a former senior British Army intelligence officer, decades of anti-terror and explosives experience in Northern Ireland, said that the liquid bomb plot was fiction. Anyway, what are your thoughts on MI5, Ken?
Well, I was reading a book written by Seamus Milne called The Enemy Within, which is all about the role of MI5 in trying to frame up Arthur Scargill and also in defeating the miners' strike,
okay.
A turning point in British history.
Okay, and that's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. We're coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest, who is Somerset-based member of the Communist Party, Ken Keeble. After the news, the humiliation and chaos of Cyprus, but what would a major euro-dollar crash look like here?
Live from the sky.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, Libyan authorities say three British aid workers have been killed.